Chapter 20, Cold Water. There's a story, I know, of a group of early pioneers who were trekking their way across the prairie to settle in the West. This group was one of the handcart companies, a collection of families who traveled with everything they owned, crammed inside a small handcart. The poorest of the poor, their handcarts were so small that a single man could push them as they moved across the prairie and even up the mountains. There were no horses in the company, no ox-drawn wagons to help them with their loads. Things didn't go well for this group of pioneers. For one thing, they didn't start their journey until late in the season. Some people told them to wait until the next year, but they had nowhere else to stay for the winter, and so they pressed on. After their late start, they had a series of problems along the way. In October, they were still on the open prairie when an early winter settled in. It was bitter cold, with snow and freezing temperatures making travel almost impossible. They were already critically low on food and completely unprepared to survive out in the open against the elements. They trudged along at a back-breaking pace, trying to make their way to the Salt Lake Valley, all the time getting lower and lower on food. The weather got worse. One by one, they started to freeze or starve to death. Every morning, it was the same thing. Wake up, gather up those who had not made it through the night. Fathers, mothers, little children. Families were devastated with broken dreams and broken hearts. The survivors would try to hack a shallow grave where they could bury their loved ones, but many times the ground was so frozen that it was impossible to dig. So they'd pile rocks over the graves in hopes of keeping the wolves and other scavengers away. Throughout the day, others would die of starvation or exhaustion, but the company could not afford to stop to bury them. Too many dead and too little time. In these cases, they'd be forced to leave the bodies of their loved ones underneath any kind of marker they could find. A lone tree, a bare shrub, a small pile of rocks. Anything was better than leaving the bodies lying atop the bare ground. Traveling in this company was a little girl whose shoes had completely worn out, leaving her to cross the prairie barefoot. Her frozen feet got so torn up that she'd leave a trail of blood in the snow behind her. She'd wrap her feet in burlap, old cloth, anything she could find to protect them. Night after night, she'd pray for a pair of shoes. One morning, she woke up to find a miracle on the ground beside her. Underneath a small bush, next to the place where she'd been sleeping, was a brand new pair of shoes. Pulling them on her bloodied feet, she found they fit her perfectly. But where had they come from? No one in the company had given her the shoes. Certainly, none of them had such a luxury within their possession, and if they had, they would have given them to her already. The little girl realized that she had been given a gift from heaven. Now, I don't mean in any way to compare my plight to the horrible experience of this little girl. She was in a life or death situation, and her suffering was much more acute than mine. But one night, I had a similar experience, and it taught me an important lesson. I'm not sure how long it was into my captivity, more than a couple of weeks, but not quite a month, I guess. We had gone a long time without going down to the stream to get any water. Maybe Mitchell was just lazy, but I don't think that that was the reason. I think something may have spooked him, causing him to be afraid to go down to the spring. Maybe he was worried that someone had become suspicious of him on one of his trips into the city. He might have seen someone down in the canyon. I don't know what it was. All I knew was I was thirsty. Down in the valley, the search efforts were still underway. Though weeks had now passed, my parents were working hard to keep the story of my kidnapping in the press. They knew it was vital to make sure that people were still aware, to keep the search efforts going and my picture in the news. From what Mitchell had told me, my posters were still up everywhere. The first time Mitchell had seen these posters, it made him very proud. But I don't think he expected the search efforts to keep going for so long, and though he tried to hide it, I could see that he was worried. Which meant that we weren't getting any water until he was certain it was safe to head down to the spring. Mitchell started to ration what little water we had left, but eventually we reached the point where we only had a few cups remaining in the bottom of one of the plastic containers. Mitchell drank, then poured a cup for Barzee, then poured the last few drops for me. Though it didn't even fill my cup, I drank it eagerly. The water was warm, having been sitting in the sun, and it tasted like melted plastic. I drank it in one gulp, then put the cup down. And that was it. The water was gone. I stared at the other water containers, but I knew they were empty. We had checked them several times already, taking off the lids and pouring out the last few drops. Still, Mitchell went over to shake them, just to make sure that they were empty. He could do that all he wanted. There was no water in the camp. It was the end of June, deep into the boiling days of summer. Utah is a desert, and it had not rained since the first week that I was captured. Temperatures hovered in the 90s, sometimes reaching above 100. A hot wind blew every afternoon, drying us like leather. My skin was dry, my throat, my eyes. I was so dirty and so thirsty that I thought I would die. After the sun had gone down, we sat around for a while to savor the cooler temperatures, but eventually we went to bed. I was always the first to crawl into the tent. Mitchell came in beside me, then Barzee beside him. Before we went to sleep, he always checked my cable to make sure it was secure. Surely, he'll go down to get water in the morning, I thought as we settled down in bed. It was the only thing that I could think of as I drifted off to sleep. That night was long and restless. Morning came. Mitchell didn't say anything about going down to the spring. I asked him, but he refused to talk to me about it. All day we sat and cooked in the summer heat. Mitchell checked the water containers once again, but all of them were dry. I had thought that being hungry was difficult, but it was nothing compared to this. Nothing compared to the burning in my throat. Nothing compared to the drive to find something to drink. And I wasn't alone. Barzee and Mitchell felt it too. I could see it in their eyes. I could hear it in the dryness of their voices. Whatever had driven Mitchell to stay away from the bottom of the canyon must have been very powerful indeed. The day dragged on, hot, miserable, dry desert heat. I was beginning to lose my energy. None of us wanted to eat. I begged Mitchell again to go down and get some water. I begged him to let me off the cable. I offered to carry the containers if he was too tired to carry them himself. I tried to understand why he couldn't go, but none of it made sense. Evening came. We went to bed. I fell into a restless sleep. I was awakened in the middle of the night. Sitting up, I looked around. The moonlight filtered through the nylon fabric, casting the inside of the tent in a pale yellow light. Mitchell was asleep beside me. Barzee was lying next to him. Both of them were breathing deeply, Mitchell's throat rattling with every breath. I looked around in the moonlight. Something had wakened me. Turning, I looked toward the front of the tent. There was a yellow cup sitting beside my pillow. I leaned toward it, checking it in the moonlight. It was filled to the very brim with water. I stared at it a moment, not believing it was real. I reached out to touch it. The cup was cold. I pulled my hand back and looked around. Was I dreaming? Was I crazy? I quickly turned to Mitchell and Barzee. Neither of them had moved. I listened. A gentle breeze blew through the tops of the trees, swaying in the night. I turned back to the water. Slowly, I reached out to touch it once again. It was cold as ice and filled to the top. I picked it up and drank it. The water cooled my throat and filled my stomach. It was cold and clear and wonderful. The best tasting water that I had ever had. After drinking, I stared at the empty cup for a long time before laying my head back on the ground. Where did the water come from? I have no explanation other than the water came from God. I know we didn't have a drop of water in the camp. I know that neither Mitchell nor Barzee would have wakened to give me any water, even if they had any left to give. And this water was fresh and cold, like it had just come from the spring. I never told them about the water. I never talked about it at all. But over the next few days, I thought a lot about what had happened. Why did God do it? How did it happen? What was God trying to say? Would I have died without the water? Certainly not. As thirsty as I felt, and as terrible as it was, I was not teetering on the edge of a life-or-death situation. And I was not alone. Mitchell and Barzee needed water, too. Mitchell wasn't going to stay up on the mountain and let us all die of thirst. Eventually, he would have had to go down to the stream. So, why did God send me the water? Because he loved me, and he wanted me to know. He wanted me to know that he was still near. He wanted me to know that he controlled the earth and all the heavens, that all things were in his hands. And if he could move the mountains, then he could do this thing for me. To him, it was a small thing, a terribly easy thing to do. But for me, it was as powerful as if he had parted the sea. This experience reminded me once again that God had not deserted me, that he was aware of my suffering and loneliness, and that assurance gave me hope. It helped me to keep my faith and gave me the strength that I needed to go on. It also gave me something else to think about. At the time, I had pretty much conceded that Mitchell might kill me, and if he didn't kill me, then I was condemned to a life of suffering and captivity. But the appearance of the water seemed to indicate that God had another plan. It told me that the fight for freedom wasn't over. God knew the end from the beginning, and there was still hope for me. In my life, I have come to believe that there are lots of examples where God provides us little miracles to give us hope. Most of these experiences are not as obvious as waking up and finding a cup of water. Some of them are much more subtle. We may even have to look for his miracles along the way. But they are there, and they're important when we are struggling with the challenging battles of this life. Chapter 21. Happy 4th of July. I spent more than 6 weeks tethered to the trees. 6 weeks having a steel cable wrapped around my ankle. 6 weeks of eating and sleeping and going to the bathroom with 2 people watching me. 6 weeks of never moving more than a few feet beyond the center of the camp. That's a long time to not have so much as a moment of privacy. It's a long time to be cabled and raped every day by one captor while my other captor talked, sang, or read her scriptures nearby. Once a week or so, Mitchell would uncable me, long enough to allow me to go down to the spring to have the bucket of water poured over my head, before being forced to carry the heavy containers of water back up the mountain. But that is the only time I was ever allowed to be free. And as soon as we got back to the camp, it was snap, and I was cabled up again. Never would he reward me for good behavior or show me any sign of affection by allowing me to spend a single moment without being cabled to the trees. And even when I went with them down to get the water, I always had the 10-foot cable around my ankle, which meant he had complete control of me. From the moment I was captured, I was a pawn in their hands. Naked, hurting, terrified of what was coming, terrified of the thought that it was 30 years to go before he died, I had no dignity, no freedom, no power over my body, no power over what I ate, what I drank, what I heard, or what I read. It was endless hours of indoctrination, hearing about their journey, hearing of their God, hearing how smart Mitchell was and how he was the chosen one. I was a prisoner in heart and mind and soul. There was no way I could have endured this abuse without falling under his control. And the worst of his manipulations was the fear that he instilled. Always the same script. "If you ever try to run, I'm going to kill you," he would hiss into my ear, his dry breath raising the hair on my neck. "He'll do it," Barzee would pipe in, ever eager to prove how deadly her husband was. "He's not kidding. He'll kill you in a heartbeat." Mitchell would pull me a little closer. "And if you ever get away, I will come and kill your family. I know where they live. I know all about them, just like I knew about you. Think of your little sister. What a cute little girl. How old is she? Maybe 9? And the little boy. He's just a baby. Do you really think you can protect them? Do you really think the police can protect them? Sure, they might keep your family safe for a while, but they can't do it forever. Time will pass, and they'll forget you. Other cases will come along. They have a lot to do. Eventually, they'll move on. They'll forget you and your family. But I won't forget you. I'll never forget your family. I'll be waiting for them, Esther. Me, my friends, we'll be waiting, watching, looking for our chance to kill them. And it will come. Sooner or later, it will come. And when it does, your entire family, every single one of them, will be dead. And it will be your fault. Do you want that? Are you so selfish that you'd really kill your family just because you want to leave me? Think about that, Esther. Are you really that kind of person? Do you want their blood on your hands? If you think that you're unhappy now, wait until you have the death of your family upon your shoulders. Imagine the guilt, the shame. Your family wants to live the same as you do, but you're going to take that from them. Esther, if you ever run away, I will come and kill them, and it will be your fault. Day after day, week after week, I heard it again and again. I can't even begin to tell you how demoralizing it was. It wore on me like a constant drip of emotional acid. I became convinced that he would do it. I became convinced that even if he was captured, he had friends who would kill my family. He seemed to have a lot of people who would help him. How else could you explain his seeming ability to produce food and drugs and alcohol out of nothing? How else to explain his ability to go down into the city without fear of being captured? He had to have others who were helping him. The more I thought about it, and I thought about it every moment of every day, the more I began to feel that my primary responsibility was to my family. I could not endanger them. I had to keep them safe. It wasn't long before Mitchell started going down into the city 3 or 4 times a week. Every time he went down, he'd bring back alcohol. And never just beer. No way he was going to haul a couple of six-packs around. It was rum and scotch and whiskey. It was gin and vodka, too. Every time that he brought back alcohol, he forced me to drink it with him. Then he started rolling cigarettes and forcing me to smoke them. A couple times he forced me to smoke some of his dope, but watching me fail to inhale it properly, he decided to keep it for himself. After a while, I began to realize that Mitchell had an inordinate interest in the descending below all things phase of becoming a great prophet. I knew the 4th of July was coming. When every day is like a century, it has a way of making you acutely aware of the passage of time. I had been begging Mitchell to let me go up to the top of the mountain to watch the fireworks. I was desperate for any kind of diversion from being cabled to the tree. More, I thought I might have a chance to escape. Maybe we'd meet someone on the top of the mountain who had hiked up to watch the fireworks as well. I knew it was unlikely, but I was desperate for any reason to hope. The day before the 4th, Mitchell had gone down to the city to get supplies. Along with his usual assortment of alcohol and crackers, he also brought back a chicken for a special 4th of July treat. It sat all day hanging in a plastic bag from a tree, and I imagined it being full of germs. But still, my mouth watered at the thought of a hot meal. Real food. Warm. Seasoned. I could hardly wait. On the afternoon of the 4th, we cleared an area right below the latrine and started a cooking fire. The first fire we had had since I'd been taken. Barzi brought out a blackened Dutch oven and placed it in the middle of the coals. I watched her pull the chicken apart and hand me the meat. I rolled the meat in flour and spices, then dropped the pieces into the oven. The oil popped and spat as the chicken began to cook. I watched it hungrily as it turned a golden brown. The chicken couldn't cook fast enough for me. For one thing, I was hungry. For another, Mitchell was on one of his rants, going on and on about all the great food he and Barzee used to eat when she had a full kitchen to tend to. I had a hard time imagining her in a flowery apron, working over a stove. This was the woman who watched me get raped every day. Hardly my idea of a happy homemaker. Soon, the lecture turned to another of his favorite subjects, the books of the Seven Diamonds Plus One. He went on about how fruit was the most perfect food on earth. It was supposed to be the main thing that we ate every day, but the greedy processed food producers and medical industry didn't want us to be well, so they kept pushing their nasty products and medicines down our throats. He told me that at one time, he and Barzee had eaten nothing but fruit for an entire year. They would go to the dumpsters behind the local grocery stores and dig out the old fruit that had been thrown away. While they were on the fruit diet, neither of them ever suffered a single ailment. They had more energy. They never got sick. I wanted to ask him why, if eating fruit was all it took to be in such miraculously great shape, they had abandoned the plan. But I didn't want to prolong the conversation. All I wanted to do was eat. Later on, after more begging that we be able to go to the top of the mountain to watch the fireworks, Mitchell suddenly unlocked the cable, allowing me to walk free. He didn't announce anything. He just walked over to the padlock, pulled out the key from around his neck, and set me free. I still had the other cable around my ankle, but at least I wasn't tethered anymore. "Don't try to run," he commanded after he unlocked me. "I will kill you if you run. I will come and kill your family. You understand me?" I nodded compliantly. I understood. "Come on," he said. I expected him to gather up the water containers and start walking down the mountain toward the spring, but he didn't. He started walking up, and for the first time, he didn't hold the other end of my cable in his hand. Then I realized that he hadn't given it the usual jerk just to remind me that I was an animal on his leash. He started moving through the trees on the east side of our camp. Barzee followed him. She seemed, I don't know, I don't want to say happy. I don't think I ever saw her happy. But she didn't seem as angry as she usually did. I watched them for a second, then started following them up the side of the mountain. The forest was thinner above our camp, with occasional open meadows, or at least a place where the trees were not as thick. The mountain dipped into a couple bowls where the terrain was not as steep. It wasn't an easy climb, but it wasn't nearly as steep as the route was toward the bottom of the canyon. As we climbed, I realized that we were not far from the route that Mitchell and I had taken on that first morning when he had led me into camp. I flashed back to my red pajamas and my white running shoes. I flashed back to my little sister lying beside me in bed. It seemed so long ago, a lifetime. Like it wasn't even real. Who was that little girl in the red pajamas? What had become of her? Who was the girl who was now living in her place? Then I realized it was the one-month anniversary of the night I had been taken, one day short of my wedding anniversary. The thought made me feel sick. As we climbed, I thought of my family, wondering what they were doing on this 4th of July. Had they forgotten me? Were they going on without me? Had they given up on the search? Surely they had. What else could they have done? I remembered that in years past we'd gone to the 4th of July rodeo up in Oakley. I used to dream of being a cowboy princess with a glittering tiara on my cowboy hat. I dreamed of carrying the American flag around the arena on the back of my horse. I knew that, it being the 4th of July, my family would have gone to my grandparents' ranch for a family party. I knew that the kids would be playing in the woods. I thought of my cousins. They'd be giggling in anticipation of playing night games, chasing one another around the huge yard. They suddenly seemed so young, so innocent, and far removed from me. I felt 100 years old. Surely, my family would have mourned my passing, I thought. But just as surely, they would have gone on with their lives. And they should have. It was the healthy and normal thing to do. My parents had other children they had to care for. It wasn't fair to them if my parents were obsessed with my loss. It was important to bring normality back into their lives. It had been more than a month. To me, it seemed like years. It must have seemed that long to them as well. And there was no reason for them to believe I was alive. No reason to believe that I was ever coming home. They couldn't go on mourning my passing every day. I pictured my mom again, still driving around our neighborhood and looking for any clues. I pictured my dad staring out the window every night. I thought of my family kneeling together to say their family prayers. Did they still pray for my safety? Did they pray that I'd return? Or did they pray now for acceptance and get past the pain of losing me? Whenever Mitchell went down into the city, he didn't talk anymore about posters or blue ribbons like he had before. No more search parties, no more airplanes or calling voices or helicopters hovering over the camp. No, they weren't looking for me any longer. Everyone had moved on. We walked up the side of the mountain. It took us about an hour, maybe a little less, to make it to the highest part of the ridge. There, the mountain opened up. It was an incredible view. I could see in every direction. The Wasatch Mountains continued to the east. Another canyon lay behind us, to the north. Looking east, I could see down into the city. Again, I was struck with how very close to home I was. If I could fly, if I could fly, I would flap my wings and fly home. Mitchell had one of his sacks and he opened it up and pulled out a rubber ball. He and Barzee started tossing it around. They invited me to throw it with them, which was difficult because of all the sagebrush and weeds. In addition, the mountain fell away on all sides of us, so we had to be careful not to let the ball roll away. Still, I joined in. We threw the ball in a triangle. "Wow, isn't this great?" I thought, sarcastically. "Here I am, playing catch with my new friends." I could have been down in the city having a barbecue with my own family, looking forward to sleeping in my own bed, not worrying about getting raped that night. But instead, I got to be up here, in a dirty white robe, throwing a ball around with two of the most evil people in the world. Night came slowly. I was glad for that. I wanted to savor every moment that I wasn't tethered between the trees. We had a simple picnic up on the mountain, then sat down and watched the sun go down. It was the first sunset I had seen in a month. The orange globe faded toward the Great Salt Lake on the west side of the city until it eventually dipped into the desert on the other side of the lake. It grew dark. We waited, sitting on the dry grass on top of the mountain. Eventually, we saw the first of the fireworks go off. They seemed so far away, little balls of sparks and fire. They were too distant to hear the sound, though if I listened very carefully and if the wind was just right, I could hear the faintest rumble from the cannonballs that blew up in the sky. Watching the fireworks, I felt more homesick than I had in weeks. Once the last of the fireballs had faded, Mitchell was suddenly eager to get back to the camp. He quickly gathered up what little he had brought up to the top of the mountain and started leading us down, his flashlight illuminating the way. I felt like I had just experienced a glimpse of spring and the dead of winter, and now I was being yanked back into the black of winter again. "Happy 4th of July," I said to myself as I followed him in the dark. After we had made our way back down to camp, Mitchell stirred the fire pit to rouse the flame. Then we sat around the fire. I considered it a real treat to have its comfort and its warmth. Barzee started cooking popcorn in a wok with olive oil and salt. As we talked, Mitchell seemed to watch me carefully, measuring the conversation as if he were waiting to say something important. I sensed that something bad was coming. After being with him in the most intimate of conditions for every moment of every day, I had a pretty good feel for his mood and intentions. He stood up to throw a small log upon the fire, then he looked at Barzee. "I think the time has come," he said. My heart sank. I had no idea what he was talking about, but I knew it wasn't good. And I couldn't imagine what could be coming that was worth the power of announcing, "The time has come." Barzee started shaking her head. "Oh no, not this."
"Yes, it is time," he said.
My heart sank even further. I turned and studied his face. His dark eyes were sullen underneath his bushy eyebrows. His hair was long and greasy and parted in the middle. His beard, full and powdered with tentacles of gray. It didn't matter. He was repulsive and ugly, wild, evil, dark and menacing. He had taken on the image of his master, and he looked like a devil now. And Barzee was no better. Her hair hung in strings at the side of her head. Her face was blotchy from the constant sun. Thick lips, puffy eyes. Her eyebrows were almost gone. Mitchell looked at Barzee, his eyes seeming to pierce the dark, though he kept his face toward her. He was talking now to me.
"The Lord has commanded us to do something. It is so hard for me to tell you, but it is time for..."
He named a certain sexual practice. My mind raced in panic. "What? What is that?" I had no idea what it meant. Then it hit me, my heart slamming in my chest as the most disgusting image crawled out from somewhere in the deepest recesses of my mind. The words that he had spoken came again into my mind.
"The Lord has commanded."
What kind of God is this, I had to wonder. In my darkest nightmares, I couldn't imagine anything that was worse than what I had been living through every day. But I guess that I didn't have a good enough imagination, for I had not imagined this. Barzee shook her head again, but then seemed to concede, her head slowly coasting to a stop. Having convinced her, a battle that had taken all of 10 seconds, Mitchell turned his attention back to me. The shadows seemed to flicker from the fire, dancing images against the trees. Mitchell's face turned a shade darker.
"Barzee and I are going down into the tent."
"Yes, yes, that's good. You two, do whatever," I thought.
"Please, don't involve me."
"Then tomorrow, we're going to demonstrate, and after that, you and I."
I lowered my head and closed my eyes. I'd never been to a slaughterhouse before, but that's exactly how I felt. I was nothing but a sheep being led to the slaughter. I wanted to die. I shook my head in despair. Mitchell and his wife stood up and disappeared into the tent, leaving me to sit by the fire. I felt as if I was completely alone in a world that had been turned on its head. I felt as if I didn't have a friend. I had reached a point where I wasn't able to fight them any longer. Whatever they told me, I simply did. I had lost every ounce of dignity, every ounce of pride, every sense of my inhibitions. But not this. Please, not this, I was praying in my mind. Eventually, they emerged from the tent. Mitchell looked at me hungrily. I shivered in my soul.
"Go to bed," he told me.
I stood and walked toward the tent, my head down. Mitchell followed into the tent to rape me. It turned out to be a long night. The next day, Mitchell got up and announced that he was going down into the city. I knew what was going to happen to me when he got back. All day long, I waited, feeling as if a guillotine were hanging over my head. I didn't eat at all that day, not a thing. I knew from sad experience that the effects of alcohol would hit me much quicker if I drank on an empty stomach, and I wanted my stomach completely empty when he came back. Mitchell came stumbling back into camp about mid-afternoon. He brought food and the regular assortment of alcohol. All of it, the hard stuff.
"Drink this," he commanded, handing me one of the bottles. "Then we're going to do that other thing."
I drank willingly. I desperately wanted the dulling effects of the alcohol to numb my senses before the nightmare began. He watched me drink, then smiled. I don't know if he wanted to get me drunk, but I suppose he did. I think he knew it was the only way I was going to be able to do what he intended. We finished half a bottle. He and Barzee started the demonstration. Then he forced me to do the same. During this experience, the same words kept rolling around in my head. Think about your family. Remember that they love you. Do whatever it takes to protect them. Whatever it takes to survive. Sometime later, I don't remember how long, it might have even been the same day, I finally got the smallest chance of revenge. He tried to kiss me, and I bit his tongue, bit it hard. He jerked back, furious. I thought he was going to hit me. He held his mouth and screamed in rage. Then he stared me down, his face contorted in pain. If you ever do that again, I'll never have sex with you. You understand that, Esther? If you hurt me, I'll never have sex with you again. You'll be the most miserable woman in the world. I stared at him, utterly dumbfounded. But that pretty much describes Brian David Mitchell's mind. That pretty much is a peek into his soul. In his opinion, I was the one who was getting the good end of the deal. I owed him for what he was doing to me. I was the luckiest girl in the world. I had the great pleasure, the great distinction of having him abuse me every day. And if I ever did anything to make him reject me, I would be the most miserable woman in the world. I can't even begin to tell you how messed up that is to me. Chapter 22. Betrayal. Why did you do this to me? I once asked him after he had just raped me. Mitchell looked at me, taking his time to answer. What did I ever do to you to deserve this? Mitchell remained quiet, thinking, which told me that a prophetic announcement was coming. I knew the routine now. When the prophet spoke, he spoke with authority. And it took a little time to generate an appropriately somber weight to his words. It was early afternoon, mid-July, the hottest and driest days of summer. We were sitting around our camp doing pretty much nothing, which was pretty much what we did every afternoon. The air was calm, and it was hot. The sky a reflective silver gray. Dust and dandelion seeds floated through the trees. It was quiet. It seemed even the birds were too quiet to chirp or move among the branches. I kept my eyes on him. I wanted an answer. I didn't deserve this, I said in a low voice, almost talking to myself. It wasn't me, he finally said. I stared at him, defiant. Of course it was you, I wanted to scream. Barzee lifted her eyes, paying close attention now. She liked it when I defied him. At least, a part of her did. Sometimes she got tired of playing second fiddle, and I think she was hoping he would put me in my place. Why did you take me? Why do this to me? I asked a final time. Mitchell took a deep breath as if he were forcing himself to be patient with a slow child. We've been through this 1,000 times before. I slowly shook my head, which instantly made him angry. You're lucky, Esther, he sneered. Don't forget that. God could have chosen another girl, but out of his great goodness, he chose you. It's a good thing that I didn't believe him, or I would have hated God forever. You would do well to show a little gratitude, he sneered again. I didn't know what to say. Moments passed in angry silence until he went on. His voice was softer now. I didn't want to do this, Esther. I didn't want to take you. It wasn't my idea. But God spoke. I had to listen. He stopped a moment, his eyes looking down. I am his prophet, Esther,
his mouthpiece here on earth. When he commands, I must obey. He could command me to move this mountain, and I would do it. He could command me to part the seas, and it would be done. Do you think I could deny him if he commanded me to take a virgin and to save her from the world? I am nothing but a servant, and when he speaks, I must obey.
He seemed to deflate as if he were weary from carrying some extraordinary weight. His face sagged with sadness.
I didn't ask for this great calling, Esther. In fact, I tried to deny it. I begged God to let this calling pass, and for a time, he did. But the world has reached a point where God couldn't let me delay any longer. He has called me once again, and this time, I must reply. It's a heavy burden, Esther. A very heavy load. But you can help me. Do you see that? When you serve me, you're serving God. And think of that great honor. Out of the entire world, the Lord has called you. You are a handmaiden to the chosen. That is such a blessing, Esther. You get to serve the servant of the Lord.
He fell silent, his statement of authority complete. I was sitting on my bucket looking down at the tiny branch that was still struggling against the summer heat. I touched it with my fingers. Keep going, little guy. Don't give up, I thought.
You know, there are more to come, Mitchell said.
I lifted my eyes to look at him.
I have been commanded to take 7 additional wives. You are only the first. All of the others are young and malleable. Young girls that I can mold into proper servants. Believe me, I have learned that they can't be so old that they will fight me. They can't be so old that they will fight the will of God.
It was true. I wasn't the first girl Brian David Mitchell had decided he had to take. Neither was I his first attempt at having a second wife. A few years before he kidnapped me, Mitchell had approached another woman about joining him and Barzee in their marriage. Of course, you don't jump into a long-term commitment like polygamy without taking each other for a little spin to test things out. So, he ended up moving in with the woman, an African-American named Kelly.
But Barzee finally put a stop to it when Kelly insisted on having Mitchell to herself.
The idea of two women fighting over Mitchell is so absurd that I can barely comprehend it. But such was the insanity that I lived with every day.
Worse than the fact that Kelly wanted Mitchell for herself was her refusal to honor Barzee as the senior wife or to recognize her in her exalted role as the Mother of Zion, whatever that meant. Angry at the lack of respect, Barzee had argued that Kelly was not chosen of God and demanded that Mitchell end the relationship. Her husband relented for a while, but then snuck back to sleep with Kelly again. At this point, Barzee ripped Mitchell from the relationship. But after some pleading and praying and explaining, Mitchell convinced her once again that his relationship with Kelly had been sanctified by God. Willing to give it another go, and always wanting to please her husband, Barzee had agreed to go with Mitchell down to Kelly's apartment so they could invite her to come and stay with them up at their campground in the mountains. But their intentions hit a snag when they found Kelly with another man. Mitchell was furious that she would betray him. Barzee was furious that the other woman would show such disrespect to her man. Spitting with anger, they withdrew the offer of marriage and left. So ended the sordid Kelly affair. But Mitchell hadn't given up on finding another wife. Soon after, he received a new revelation. He was not to take one wife, but 7. And he was to focus on young girls, those who would be less likely to get involved with another man. And they needed to be pure and from a Mormon home. Knowing what he wanted, but not having given any thought as to how he was going to get it, he simply found a young girl he fancied and followed her on the bus one day. Noticing that he was following her, the young girl had waited until the last second at one of the bus stops, then suddenly jumped off, leaving him on the bus as the bus pulled away.
After Mitchell had told me this story, I often thought of that girl. Good for you, I thought. You did the smart thing. I am glad you got away. But part of me had to wonder why I had to be the one who was cabled to the trees. I rarely got a chance to talk. Mitchell did all of that. Days, weeks, months of listening to him go on and on. But sometimes even he couldn't keep it up, and there would be a lull in the one-sided conversation. Sometimes he would even ask me a question. It was extraordinarily rare. But sometimes I got to talk about something that I wanted to talk about, which was always my family. It was the only thing I cared about, the only thing I ever thought about. I was desperate to keep their memories clear in my mind. Even if they had moved on, and I had accepted that they had, I had not moved on. They were my only hope, my only joy. The only thing I lived for was the thought that one day I might return to them. But Mitchell hated it when I talked about my family. He hated it if I even mentioned them in passing. It was as if I were talking about something so foul and disgusting that it had to be avoided at all costs. This from a guy who was pretty hard to disgust. Whenever I mentioned my family, he would instantly get angry. Get past it, Esther. You have to move on. This is your life now. You have to let your former life go. I don't want to hear about them, Esther. Not now. Not tomorrow. Never again. One day toward the middle of July, Mitchell was complaining about his mother. She had been granted a restraining order against him after he had pushed her down a flight of stairs, and it made him angry that he couldn't go near her anymore. As part of the conversation, he mentioned where she lived. My cousin, Olivia, lives in that neighborhood, I said without thinking. She and I were very close. Realizing what I said, I flinched against his coming anger at the mention of my family. But he didn't rip my head off, like I thought that he would. I waited longer. He didn't say anything. I felt elated. He was going to let me talk. We used to play together in her yard. She had a great swing in one of her trees in the front yard, and a small treehouse in a pear tree. I loved being there. We had such fun together. Mitchell seemed to think. I know that house, he said. It is very near my mom's house. Yellow paint, right? I was so excited to think about my cousin. Yeah, the yellow house. Olivia and I were very close. We're the same age, you know. I could play with her and my other cousins all the time, in the treehouse, on the swing. Surprisingly, Mitchell allowed me to go on. It was like Christmas morning. I could talk about my family. I described the times that we had played together, the things that we would do, more about where they lived. I had no idea that I had betrayed my cousin until the next day. Mitchell came out of the tent in the morning. I was already up, and so was Barzee. He wandered over to the small container where we used to store our food and poked around inside, but didn't take anything out to eat. Straightening up, he looked at me and forced a smile, which made me nervous. I have to tell you something, Esther. I felt the familiar feeling of my stomach falling. You're not going to like it. I was already braced, but the truth was, there was very little he could say or do to me that would have shocked me any longer. I didn't feel anything anymore. The soul that lived inside me had been pushed so far down that everything I did was simply going through the motions. But even though I had retreated, I knew that something new was coming, and I was sick with dread. The Lord has commanded me to go out again. He kept his snake eyes on me. He has commanded me to go and take Olivia to be my next wife. I'm going to go and get her and bring her back here. The blood rushed from my brain. I felt like I was going to fall over. I had to steady myself as I stifled a scream. I had planted the idea. I had betrayed my own cousin by the things I had said. I felt the crushing weight of utter despair. Mitchell knew from experience that it was going to take planning and preparation to get what he wanted. He spent a week or so putting the plan in place. He decided that he was going to kidnap Olivia on July 24th, a state holiday commemorating the day the Mormon pioneers made their way into the Salt Lake Valley. He knew there would be lots of traffic and parades and parties and city fireworks that night. The police would be preoccupied, leaving him a little more slack to do his evil thing. Thinking of what he was going to do made me sick with guilt. What would Olivia think when she was dragged into camp and saw me here? She would know I had betrayed her. She would know it was my fault. How could I ever face her? How could she ever forgive me? And if the police ever came to rescue us, they would think it was my fault too. Would I be sent to jail for helping Mitchell with this terrible crime? I know that sounds ridiculous, but I was young and thoroughly brainwashed about how the safety of my family was my responsibility. Then I had the worst thought of all. What if she was hurt, or even murdered, while Mitchell was trying to kidnap her? The fact that I planted the idea in Mitchell's mind was almost more than I could bear. But I have to admit that there was a tiny bit of me, a very tiny bit, that wanted her there with me. Together, we could find a way to escape. We would have each other. It wouldn't be so bad. But whenever I thought of this, I felt guilty. I knew my secret wish was incredibly selfish. There was no way I could wish this upon anyone. The morning of July 24th finally came. Mitchell spent the day preparing for his crime. He packed his two green packs and tied them together with the same piece of dirty cloth that he'd used on the night he came to get me. Although he didn't show me the deadly knife, I knew he had it with him. He ate and then rested, knowing he had a long, hard night ahead of him. First, he had to hike down into the city. Then he'd take a bus to the southeastern section of the valley. After kidnapping Olivia, he'd have to climb up Big Cottonwood Canyon, a canyon that leads to some of Utah's most aggressive ski terrain. Big Cottonwood is also famous among mountain climbers for its steep granite walls. The canyon is rimmed with so many sheer granite cliffs that in most places it would be impossible to climb, and he'd have to do it with a terrified prisoner in tow. Olivia would be thinking of me. She would think I'd been killed. Armed with that information, surely she would be more aggressive in trying to escape. Once they made it to the top of the mountain, Mitchell would have to drag Olivia north across the ridgelines for, I don't know, 10 or 15 miles. I knew how exhausting and time-consuming all of this was going to be. All morning, Mitchell tried to act as if a terrible burden had been placed upon his shoulders. God has commanded me. I must obey. But it is so difficult, so difficult. Not what I want to do at all, but I must pass another test of faith, for I am the prophet of the Lord. But I knew it was all an act. He was acting it very poorly. He couldn't keep the lusty smile from his face. It was obvious that he was keyed up and full of anxious energy. He was going to get another child, another wife, another toy. And as I watched him, I realized that he would never be satisfied. The evil that was inside him would always make him lust for more. My heart raced as I watched him pick up the two sacks and throw them across his back. Olivia, I'm so sorry, I was crying in my head. Please, God, please protect her. Please, God, make him fail in this thing. I will do anything if you will spare her from what I am living through every day. All day long I waited, too sick to eat. I sat on my bucket and prayed. I begged and cried and pleaded with God to protect my cousin. If Barzi was concerned, she didn't show it, though she did seem a little more terse than normal. She went about her daily routine, then sat and read and sewed and prepared a small meal. The day passed more slowly than any day in my life, the afternoon sun dragging across the gray sky. Afternoon passed, and then the evening. Night came. We waited. Barzi was getting nervous now. It grew late. Still, no Mitchell. We waited. We went to bed. I didn't sleep.
Midnight. The moonlight lit the trees around us in a pale white light. Early morning came. We were in our tent. "He's not coming back," I thought. "He didn't get Olivia. He's been captured. He's in prison right now." Lifting up on one elbow, I looked across the tent at Barzee, feeling suddenly terrified while imagining what might have happened. "He got caught, but he isn't going to tell them about us. He isn't going to betray his wife. He'll be silent. He'll give her time to escape. He'll give her time to get out of town, to get on a bus and leave the state. He'll do whatever it takes to protect her. And he certainly won't tell the police about me. No way he'll volunteer the fact that he has me cabled up here in the trees, and he has the key to my steel cable around his neck. I almost panicked. Barzee would leave me here to die. I lay my head back on the pillow and tried to go to sleep. Early the next morning, I heard the snap of branches and the crunch of footsteps on dry leaves. Then I heard the soft sound of Mitchell singing as he walked up the hidden trail toward our camp. My heart sank. He sounded much too happy. I slowly closed my eyes. Mitchell sat on a bucket to tell us what had happened. He was alone. No Olivia. I wanted to cry with gratitude.
"She is not the one the Lord has chosen to be my next wife," he announced.
Barzee stared at him without reacting. I lifted my hand to hide my smile. "Not the one the Lord has chosen." "Okay, so we ran into a problem. Guess the Lord changed his mind." Mitchell went over and poured a long drink of warm water from one of the plastic containers, then settled down to tell his story, and because he liked to talk, he told it in great detail. After hiking down into the city, the first thing he did was go to the nearest store and plunder a beer. He gulped it by the cooler, then plundered a couple more. Then he made his way to the bus stop. About this time, he needed to relieve himself from the quickly guzzled beer. With no restrooms around, he sat in the yard of the nearest house, slid forward so that his robe would not get wet, and urinated on the lawn. Gross, but that was like him. Part human, part devil, part animal. After getting on the bus, he took the long route to Olivia's neighborhood. By the time he got there, it was dark. Still, it was way too early to sneak into Olivia's house to take her. Slinking in the darkness, he made his way to his mother's house and snuck into her side yard, where he and Barzee had left their beloved hand house, a tiny handmade house on wheels with a bar in the front so two people could pull it. He and Barzee had pulled this hand house all over the Salt Lake Valley as they journeyed for the Lord. He crawled into the hand house, slithered under a pile of old clothes, and waited until it was the dead of night. When it was the darkest and quietest part of the night, he slid out from underneath the old clothes and headed to my cousin's house, a few blocks away. Circling like a wolf, he checked out the house, looking for the best way to get in. He checked all the doors. They were locked. He checked the windows until he found one that was open, just a crack. Then, just like he had done at my home, almost 2 months before, he took a patio chair and leaned it up against the side of the house underneath the partially opened window. Climbing onto the chair, he opened the window and cut a long slit in the screen. He stopped and listened. He waited. He heard nothing. He reached his hand through the slit in the screen to push the blinds back. Crash! Something fell off the windowsill and shattered upon the floor. He froze, not even breathing, his heart pounding in his chest. He listened. No voices or any footsteps. He took a deep breath, then pushed the blinds back once again. Another crash, and he knocked another decoration onto the floor. Then he heard the sound of footsteps pounding down the hallway. The lights came on and someone started shouting. Realizing that the Lord had not chosen Olivia to be his next wife, he turned and ran, the green bags bouncing like crazy across his back. Running as far as his breath would take him, he finally had to stop and rest. It took him several bus rides to get back to our canyon, then a long hike back up the trail. He never spoke of Olivia again. Chapter 23. Barzee Takes Off. Mitchell and Barzee were
always fighting. You would think that in such an austere situation as we were living in, there would be little to fight about. But they always found something. Lack of food, the condition of our clothing, whether it was going to rain. What to do and when to do it. When to pray and what to pray about. But the main thing they fought about was me. And the reason was pretty simple. Barzee hated me, and Mitchell was never going to let me go. A few weeks after Mitchell's failed attempt to kidnap my cousin, he and Barzee got into a serious fight. After hours of screaming and cursing, Barzee finally took off, running down the side of the mountain. We watched her disappear, the sound of her crashing through the brush eventually fading into the distance. I turned to Mitchell. "Will she come back?" I asked. "Of course she will." Silence for a moment. I wasn't sure. Has she ever taken off like that before? Nope. Mitchell pretended he didn't care. We waited and waited. No sign of her. I felt creepy being with him by myself. As much as I hated Barzee, I hated being alone with Mitchell even more. It was like being alone with the devil. It made my skin crawl. Mitchell seemed completely unconcerned that Barzee had run away. Figuring he'd take advantage of the privacy, he took the time to rape me. The afternoon passed. I could see that Mitchell was starting to get worried. "Do you think she went down to the city?" I asked. "Of course not." He brushed off my ridiculous suggestion. We continued waiting. Finally, Mitchell decided that we had to go and find her. He walked over to the cable to unlock me. "Where are we going?" I asked, overjoyed to be free for a moment. "She must have gone down to one of the other camps," he said. Mitchell had spoken several times about these other camps. Apparently, there were two of them. Both were down the canyon and much closer to the main trail at the bottom of the mountain. Both were outfitted with necessary supplies, tents, water, tarps. He and Barzee had used them before they had kidnapped me, but never after. They were too dangerous, too close to the city and popular hiking trails. Watching Mitchell unlock me, my heart started pounding with excitement. I was going to be uncabled. That alone was enough to make me want to cry with joy. After nearly 2 months of being treated like an animal, I can't begin to explain how wonderful it was to have a moment of freedom. And we were going down the canyon, closer to my family, closer to civilization. Maybe I would see someone who could rescue me. Maybe I would be found. But I had already decided that I would never run away. I had tried twice already, and both times failed, with severe chastening and warnings. Some people wonder how I could have become so subject to Mitchell's will, so utterly submissive and obedient, but when you consider my situation, it's pretty easy to understand. For one thing, I was only 14 years old, and I was as naive as any 14-year-old girl could be. My innocence had been torn apart, and it seemed that Mitchell had done it with utter confidence and ease. He had shown the ability to get into my house, to pull me from my bedroom, to keep me in the mountains just a few miles from my home. Time and time again, he would hike down into the city with not a penny to his name, then return with all sorts of alcohol and supplies. He avoided the police. He avoided any suspicion. He seemed to move around the city without any fear at all. He may not have been omnipotent, but he seemed to get away with everything. Physiologically, I was tattered. I had been tortured for months, deprived of water, deprived of food, treated like an animal. No privacy, no hope. I lived in constant pain from being abused and cabled to the trees. I had been threatened and manipulated every second of every day. Mitchell was the master, and I was the slave. I was also terrified of making him angry, and I wasn't alone. His own family was afraid of him as well, to the point that they had disowned him. His own mother had a restraining order placed against him. He seemed to have lost all of the normal emotions that humans were supposed to feel. He abused me as easily as someone might flick an ant off the kitchen table. And Barzee was no better. She had voluntarily given up her children in order to be with him. She watched him abuse me without any compassion or any attempt to help me. To her, I was nothing but competition for his affections, and I believed she would have killed me if he had given her the go-ahead. I felt constantly outnumbered. It was one child against two adults, both of whom were evil and full of darkness. But they were not stupid, especially Mitchell. He was smart and experienced at his craft. He had been lying and manipulating his way through life for many years now, and I was no match for his distortions. But none of these factors explains the main reason I was so obedient to his commands. Fear was the reason. Fear for my own life. Fear for my family. Terror had been my constant companion from the moment that I opened my eyes in the darkness of my bedroom to see Mitchell standing there. Every moment of every day, I was sick with dread. After a time, that begins to change you. It changes the way you think, your expectations, the things you hope to get out of life. I knew that he would kill me if I tried to run away. Nothing could have convinced me that wasn't true. He'd kill my family. I wanted to protect them. I felt driven to protect them. Mitchell would kill my family if I ran, so I wasn't going to run. As we prepared to go down the canyon, I felt my only hope for escape was that we would, at some point, be put in a situation where someone else could save me. But that process had to be completely out of my control. It couldn't be my fault. I couldn't contribute to my own rescue in any way. Otherwise, Mitchell would blame me. Then he would kill my family, or tell his friends to kill them. And as horrible as my life was, it was far preferable for me to suffer than to hurt those I loved. We headed down the mountain toward the stream at the bottom of the canyon. For a short time, we walked along the trail that ran parallel to the tiny stream, sometimes crossing back and forth to walk on dry ground. But after a while, Mitchell made us hike back up onto the side of the mountain, then track a different course to the canyon, making our way toward the lower camp. It was hard going, cutting through the mountain oak and brush. Eventually, we made it to the first of the lower camps, a small clearing surrounded by outcroppings of rock. It was almost completely hidden, and we had to climb down the side of sheer rocks before dropping into the camp. Mitchell quickly looked around, searching for any sign of Barzee. He grew very agitated when it was obvious that she had not been there. We climbed out of the camp and headed down the mountain again. It took some real bushwhacking to cut our way across the side of the mountain. I had on some old wool socks, and from time to time I would stop and try to pull the burrs and stickers out of them, but eventually I just gave up. They were completely plastered. It didn't do any good. As we got closer to the bottom of the canyon, Mitchell became more and more angry, constantly cursing that we were getting so close to the main trails. The second camp was located in a small meadow nestled on the side of the canyon. Surrounded by thick trees, this camp, like the previous one, was completely hidden from view. We stopped at the edge of the trees, and Mitchell looked around, searching for any sign of trouble, before he led me into the camp. The camp was pretty well supplied. A small tent, water, a few tarps, a couple small plastic containers of camping gear. Mitchell searched through all their belongings, looking again for any sign that Barzee or anyone else had been there. Finding nothing, he stood and looked around, his hands balled into anxious fists. He stared down the canyon, then back up toward our camp. Then he made his decision. No way he was going to take me any farther down the canyon. It was time to turn around. "Come on," he mumbled as he passed me. I turned and followed him as we started the long hike back to our camp. I kept my head low, my spirits deflating. Every step took me closer to my prison. Every step took me closer to a life that was killing my soul. Every step was like adding another rock onto an emotional backpack that was already very full. We eventually made it back to camp. By then, it was getting very late, the last of the sunlight fading through the trees. The first thing Mitchell did was cable me up again. Then he started telling me, again, how each of us had a cross that we must bear, but how much God must have loved me to give me the opportunity to be his wife. While he was talking, we heard someone walking through the trees. Both of us turned to see Barzee emerge from the brush. Though she didn't seem as angry as she had been before, there was a definite chill in the air. She and Mitchell talked. He reminded her once again that she was the chosen Mother of Zion. He reminded her that she was assured a position up in heaven at the right hand of God, a position right next to the Savior himself, if only she stayed faithful to what God needed her to do. What a bunch of garbage, I thought as I listened to him talk. A few days later, we were out of food again. Mitchell was preparing to go down to get supplies when Barzee confronted him. Why do you get to go down and drink your liquor and get your smokes and do whatever you want to do while Esther and I are left up here to starve, waiting for your return? He glared at her, but she stood her ground without flinching. It isn't right. I'm tired of it. I'm not going to do it anymore. He started to answer, but Barzee took a step toward him, her face as hard as ice. I'm not going to stay up here and starve while you go down and party, she said with scorn, and I could tell Mitchell was going to have to back down. Barzee didn't win very many of their arguments, but once she had made up her mind, there was no backing down. She was tired of him going into the city and never allowing her to go. It had been going on for months now. Something was going to change, which was good, really good, because I knew there was no way they would leave me up at camp by myself. Seeing the opening, I started begging him to let me go down to the city too. My mind was racing with possibilities. Maybe someone would recognize me. Maybe someone would rescue me. Maybe Mitchell would, I don't know, get captured? Have a heart attack? Decide he didn't want me? Anything was possible. I begged and I begged. But Mitchell was having none of it. Both of us were going to stay up in the camp. No, Emmanuel, I'm not. I'm not going to do it anymore, Barzee shot back. It took a lot more pushing, but eventually, Mitchell was forced to give in.